Hey everybody, it's Paul Romhani from Vanishing Magic Magazine. Welcome to the very first semi-podcast. Once a month, we will be offering subscribers an audio version of Vanish. This is the very first time any magic magazine has done this. So as well as the written part of Vanish, you can now get some of the articles on audio. Podcasts are becoming so popular, I thought why not include this with your subscription to Vanish. And this is the very first one. So I'm really honored to have Harrison Greenbaum featured in this issue of Vanish Magic Magazine. And his interview really is one of the most direct and honest I think I've published in the past 14 years. I got to see him do a full evening show in front of a crowd of several hundred. And then the next day I attended a workshop, which was truly remarkable. You know, I wish I'd seen this 30 years ago because his advice was a real masterclass in how to combine magic with comedy and how to structure a show. He is a rare master of the craft, and we are very fortunate to have him in this issue of Vanish. So I know you're going to love this. So either reading this or the audio version, either way, you're going to really enjoy it. Ari Rose is a star on the rise and brings a real fresh approach to magic. And thanks to Connie Boyd for sitting down with Ari and getting the scoop on this very authentic performer. In other news, Misty Knight is currently on a major network series called The Next Chef. And in this issue of Vanish, Misty is featured, and she's really doing well on that show, and she's a great ambassador for magic. Finally, if you are in Europe, I will be touring in May, so check out this issue of Vanish Magic Magazine. I will be in Luxembourg, France, everywhere. You name it, I'm all over Europe just for the month of May. So check out this issue of Vanish Magic Magazine, see the dates, and there's an email you can check just to get the time and where I will be lecturing. So that's it. Let's get on with the magazine.
Hi, this is Connie Boyd from Magical Women and Vanish, March 2025. This month's feature article is about Ari Rose. Ari Rose is a charismatic emerging talent, presenting magic with stylish flair and carving out her own distinctive magic brand. Classically trained as a dancer, her debut in magic began as a magician's assistant with illusions. However, it wasn't the puzzling grand illusions that intrigued and piqued her magic passion. Instead, she gravitated to close-up and mentalism magic. Ari shared, "I was drawn to skillful magic that had the ability to be self-contained and that could be brought with me anywhere, performed anytime." About being a female in magic, she elaborated, "Magic, in my opinion, is naturally alluring. Between the secrets, the impossibilities, the smoke and mirrors, it truly complements the allure of a woman. Plus, the built-in feminine misdirection of the bat of an eyelash or a smile is a very helpful tool as well." Ari applied her theatrical training and discipline to the challenge of learning and perfecting sleight-of-hand techniques and challenging moves. "If I'm honest, it's hard as heck and requires a drive and dedication like no other. But when you finally get that one move, that one routine, that one method, it's worth it all." Beyond the resilience, creativity, and patience she applies to mastering execution, Ari strives to connect with her audiences on an emotional level. She elaborated, "Most people don't often have the opportunity to experience magic executed directly in front of them. I love making a lasting impression by being authentic and magical." Beyond building a solid foundation within her magic techniques, Ari believes that authenticity in performance is the key to success. She shared, "Being yourself and coming from a place of sharing and giving the audience an experience, as opposed to just fooling them, makes the impression stronger. This applies to stage as well. While it's an amplified version of you, it's still you, as a person, connecting and relating with other people." Her theater and dance training have been huge assets. She was quickly ahead of the game by understanding the importance of staging skills, choreography, and body posture. Those abilities have allowed her to enhance the overall performance flow with the natural impressions of her movements during performances. She laughed. I even use those skills in strolling and casual settings. Remember, your stage can be anywhere, and it's where you create and make your own magic. You are in control of that. Mary is definitely on an upward trajectory, and opportunities are happening for her now. She is proud of what she is achieving and thrilled to be a part of the Mystify Magic convention this month, and also has another notable convention booking, which she is not able to announce just yet. It's not all shiny and new. Ari admitted that she struggles with self-doubt and destructive comparisons to others, a common thread that many artists can relate to. To overcome the negativity, she focuses on the positives, allowing herself to acknowledge the improvements, growth, and milestones she's accomplished. Her work ethic and forward focus towards improving and becoming the best she can be is a big benefit. She explained, I am trying to give myself grace, to be kind to myself when it's needed. As a contemporary magician, she has a strong presence and followings on most social media platforms. While it's possible to have control of the factors, such as angles, environment, and lighting, Ari prefers to present her magic uploads as she would a live performance, staying true to her performance vision and craft. Social media is a huge part of her marketing and exposure as a magician. It's also a good place to test creative ideas out, expanded Ari. It's helped me immensely with connections and meeting magicians that I would never have had the opportunity to be engaged with. I found that it is useful with bookings and that it can be a super helpful tool to show a little snippet of what you do, what your style is, and the comments also establish how the audience will relate and respond. The variables and unknown facts that can occur in television and live performance broadcast tapings are trickier. You don't know exactly where the camera is and or which camera they will be using. I navigate those challenges by being hyper aware and also choosing routines that aren't terribly angle sensitive. That awareness also applies to close-up and strolling scenarios. In closing, Ari shared, my favorite moment to date occurred after I had completed a gig and a few people approached me and said they loved my presentation and style of magic, that they felt I had a personal impact and connection with them. That is, after all, why I do what I do and why I am passionate and love magic. Roots. Well, admittedly starting to study magic in her early 20s, later than most, Ari's movement training has been a huge asset. She is acutely aware of her body placement and positioning, and that has been a big benefit with muscle memory and magic technique coordination. She shared, it would have been easier if I had started magic earlier, but I'm also happy that I started when I did because of the opportunities that I have thanks to other skills I have. Paralleling her dance training, Ari focused and learned the magic fundamentals. She chose props that she was drawn to and that made her practice sessions fun and easy to commit to. For example, for beginners starting in magic, she suggests, find the type of magic that you enjoy, but don't entirely write off all the other fields and styles. Be open to studying other forms of magic. You might be surprised to find a different type of magic that you like and that feels most like you. When she first started, she learned through YouTube. videos, DVD tutorials, and at magic clubs. She was a quick study, and her early posts and performances attracted the eye of notable magicians. She feels very fortunate and cites mentors John Armstrong, Vincent Davila Bustelo, Kenton Knepper, Rocco Colt, Nathan Colmarsh, and Malik Santos as being important influencers and supporters of her work, technically and creatively. She also acknowledges Bev and Eloise Bergeron, Ring 170, alongside the Jim and Joyce Zachary Assembly 266, for being instrumental in her growth and development. To anyone out there considering to learn magic, remember, the path may be challenging, but the rewards are beyond enchanting. As she looks forward, Ari is excited about the future of magic and inspired by the talented young magicians and creators developing new effects and new presentation viewpoints of the classics. She enthusiastically explains, "It's a wonderful thing. I have always loved the saying, learn the rules so you can break them." And I think that sums up the future of magic. Ari Rose has a bright future ahead. She is humble, dedicated, and determined to expand and grow as a magician and artist. Her creed is be creative, be authentically you, and make your magic meaningful. She expanded, "I learned that authentic and genuine presentations that come from the heart really resonate with people I perform for. I always want my audience to be connected to me and to feel welcomed, comfortable, and joyful when they experience my magic. In the end, we are all human and we all have similar experiences. So why not share and bring happiness and wonder to those that we can?" Nocturne Magic. Ari Rose and Rocco Colt have recently developed and launched a new magic company called Nocturne Magic. Their mandate: to provide easy access, unique and exciting magic effects that will appeal to a multitude of performers' styles and specialities. Their goal: that their magic products will be found in the hands of magicians and mentalists everywhere, regardless of a performer's genre of magic. Their quest: to have individual effects available to appeal to everyone. Ari explained, "We plan to produce practical, impactful, and killer magic effects that will be able to fit right into every magician and mentalist pocket. To start, we have opened our shop with three original effects, which include Primary Caps, which is a Nocturne Magic exclusive, the Parasitic, and the Needle Project." Ari and Rocco met through social media and have become inseparable best friends quite quickly. Their common love for magic, working through issues, developing effects, and finding solutions to problems meshed during late-night jam sessions. Together, they decided to form their own company, Nocturne Magic, to share their enthusiasm for stellar magic and magic effects with like-minded others. You can learn more about Nocturne Magic at www.nocturnemagic.com. Now, here are some secrets revealed. "I am and have been a professional dancer for over 6 years, and I have studied classical dance for almost all of my life. The lessons and techniques are still something I employ when I perform magic. I love animals and have been a vegetarian for 14 years. I love fashion and aesthetics, and I express myself quite a bit through fashion and makeup, including during my gigs." Ari's favorite quote: "Do not go where the path may lead. Go instead where there is no path and leave a trail." Ralph Waldo Emerson. Her dream encounter: "I've always thought that David Bowie would be a fascinating person and artist to meet and talk to over coffee. He was such a unique artist and authentically himself.
Four Magical Books. Our Magic by Maskelyne and Devant, 1911. Neo Magic by S.H. Sharp, 1932. Showmanship for Magicians by Dariel Fitzky, 1945. Magic and Showmanship by Henning Nelms, 1969. I know you are busy. Don't have a lot of time. You want success yesterday, right? The books listed above take less than 6 inches on any shelf. But maybe you just buy a download PDF and you don't even need shelf space. So for 20th century dwellers, let me offer a few thoughts about paper books, who owned them, and what you can learn. Firstly, my journey began with another book also very worthwhile. Don't even question what you have to pay for the green cover copy of the 1972 The Amateur Magician's Handbook by Henry Hay. It is from that masterwork, some call it the most influential book in magic in the latter half of the 20th century, originally published in 1950. Hay directed me to these masterworks that will help you, one, make magic an art in your hands, two, create the feeling of wonder for your audience, three, instill love of research and appreciation for creativity. Our Magic, 1911. You have to understand two things. The time the book was written and what happened 1880 to 1920. Since 1920, historians basically agree that this period was the Golden Age. Magic was represented as a legitimate art form seen on the stage as you would the ballet or symphony. At the Egyptian Hall, Maskelyne and his partners occupied two theaters in London from 1873 to 1933, 60 years of continuous magic destroyed by war. Only in 2023 did the Magic Castle in Hollywood, California, exceed that record. John Neville Maskelyne's son, Neville, and David Devant were the standard for magic in Victorian and Edwardian London for more than half a century. Why? Our Magic basically sets forth a dramatic inquiry as to what is false art and offers pearls to develop. In 2025, this book is your high diving board. Jump off! Trust me, the water is fine and welcoming. If you're a kid and you can get your hands on this book and you really study, take notes, try hard, and don't fear failure, glorious success can be yours. This first edition formerly belonged to master engineer and clown magician, my close friend, Harry Kohlstock, 1923 through 2012. Neo Magic, 1932. Sam Sharp has been called Magic's Aldous Huxley, a deep thinker. I knew him. He liked my work. I only mention that because he helped me with advice in written letters after we met in 1986 via the courtesy and long-distance driving of my friend Eddie Dawes. Sharp is perfectly direct that as a boy he had dreams of outdoing Maskelyne and Devant. That's like a young Derek Jeter saying at age 14 he would become the shortstop for the New York Yankees. I am sure that Sharp was told the same thing young Derek also heard. Son, there's a few guys more qualified ahead of you for that job. Nevertheless, Derek Jeter did become the shortstop for the New York Yankees, retiring at age 39 with approximately $300 million to his name, buying several sports teams and opening a publishing house. Sam Sharp, equally, may not have been the stage magician either comparable or excelling Maskelyne and Devant, but he wrote a book that my wife paid auction prices for, a present, to acquire a first edition from 1932. I have a student. She doesn't necessarily want to learn tricks, she told me. I want to learn to achieve the unachievable. We've had a discussion about how me handing her a wad of money doesn't teach her to learn to make money. I am a long-distance runner. My theatrical marathon has lasted 3 years. She wants to know how. I reply, learn something original, something only you do. Make sure you can do this to perfection anywhere in the world, preferably with as few words as possible. Then, and only then, will you have the tools to call your own shots, name your own price, stick by it. Because, as Marvin Roy learned and taught, if they can only buy your product from you, you have a lock on your market. Sam Sharp takes the voice of a discontented individual offering a way forward as bombs were soon to drop on London when this book was originally published by George Johnson at the Magic Wand offices, who had published Sidney Rangel Clark's masterwork, The Annals of Conjuring, only 3 years earlier in book form, previously serialized in the magazine. This copy formerly belonged to Max Maven, 1950 through 2022. What could be so important to pay prestige prices for? Sharp begins by acknowledging several previous texts he wishes to respond to, including Our Magic, an intellectual ladder grew. Showmanship for Magicians, 1945. Like Sharp discussing the discontent he finds with most performances of magic, Daryl Fitzke, born Daryl Fitzroy, 1898 through 1977, certainly knew of the other two books. The Fitzke trilogy has come to be as important in launching the mind of the professional magician as the Tarbell course in magic. I remember many late nights at Ray Goulet's Magic Art Studio working on books and conversations with Boston's Magic Man, how, if you had Tarbell and Fitzke, you don't really need anything else. Probably street wisdom by those who knew from playing gigs. It would be wrong to disperse information given me backstage by a slide guitar player in a very famous band, but I can tell you that this band has been touring since I was a kid, and the leader of this band makes every person who joins read Showmanship for Magicians. You might ask yourself, why? You'll answer that question when you pick up a copy and fall into a whole world you may never have even thought about. The copy shown formerly belonged to the great English magician Stanley Collins, 1881 through 1966, and Dr. Edwin A. Dawes, 1925 through 2023. The copy shown is signed to Collins by Fitzke and has notes and inserts by the previous owners. Magic and Showmanship, 1969. Henry Hayes seemingly never stops mentioning this book in his 1972 paperback, The Amateur Magician's Handbook. There is good reason. Again, you kind of have to know two things to get this book. One, Henning Nelms was a very knowledgeable theater director, and he loved magic. Two, because of television in the 1960s, the world's wars were brought into living rooms initially. As life works, the opposite arrived in what was temporarily called New Vaudeville. That is, the counterculture shouted anti-war, and part of that was street performance by the San Francisco Mime Company, not entirely silent, and Harry Anderson, 1952 through 2018, was already doing his legendary bullet catch at the famous Ashland, Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And Jeff Sheridan was performing in New York City, but had not yet found his stage at the Sir Walter Scott statue, where he became the father of modern street magic. Nelms took close observation of what was happening in the street, at festivals, and on stage, and this book is his comment on how Fitzke felt two decades later. Vaudeville was gone, and new vaudeville would not really hit its commercial stride, not that this was really the goal by the true practitioners, until the mid-70s. David Blaine took many of Nelm's ideas, theories, and put them on video. Nelm counsels that meaning is what makes magic memorable. He offers that making a handkerchief appear may be pleasant to witness, but make a ham sandwich appear for a starving man, we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. It appears as if the illusion of the appearing sandwich is real magic, because meaning is attached, hunger abated. Blaine made cascading coins appear for a man begging change on a city street. Superman Revisited. You want to learn how to make your magic more penetrating? Give it meaning. Not false art meaning, as you see on insipid TV shows. You have to understand the human animal you seek to entertain. Nelms is a stellar start. The copy shown is about the fourth copy I've owned because I keep giving it to people who want to be better magicians. A son of a very famous magician called me. He, too, is a full-time magician, having commanded big shows all over the world. He asked what I was doing. "Reading a book," I replied. Silence at the other end of the line. Finally, he said, "Reading a book? Who has time to read a book?" I told him, "In my opinion, you don't have time not to read a book." Ben Robinson has been a magician for 50 years. His newest book, Magic Hall, 40 Stories of True Wonder.
Harrison Greenbaum telling it exactly like it is. Harrison Greenbaum is a rare breed of performer, seamlessly blending the worlds of stand-up comedy and magic in a way that keeps audiences laughing just as much as they are left in awe. With razor-sharp wit and impeccable sleight of hand, he has carved out a unique niche in the entertainment industry, earning accolades from both the comedy and magic communities. He's been described as the hardest-working man in comedy magic by both the New York Daily News and Time Out New York. Greenbaum has performed thousands of shows around the world, appearing in some of the most prestigious venues and on television programs that has solidified his reputation as one of the most dynamic entertainers of his generation. Now, I got to see Harrison's full evening show in Vancouver last year, then attended his masterclass on comedy and magic. It was, without question, the best workshop I had ever attended, and I really wish I had seen it 30 years ago, as it would have changed my entire outlook on how to blend comedy and magic together. You are in for a real treat, as I was able to sit down with him and ask Harrison questions that will give us a real insight into his way of thinking and hopefully get to know him a little better. Now, he was born and raised in New York. Greenbaum's love for both comedy and magic began early. As a child, he was captivated by the wonder of magic, honing his skills and practicing relentlessly. At the same time, his sharp sense of humor and quick-thinking ability made him a natural for stand-up comedy. It was while attending Harvard University, he founded the Harvard College Stand-Up Comics Society, a move that foreshadowed the career path he would eventually take. Instead of choosing between his two passions, Greenbaum merged them, creating an act that seamlessly integrates the art of illusion with timing and unpredictability of stand-up. His career trajectory, it's easy for me to say, has been nothing short of impressive. He has performed at the legendary comedy clubs like the Comedy Cellar and Caroline's on Broadway, while also taking center stage at magic conventions such as Magic Live and Blackpool. Now, Greenbaum has been featured on America's Got Talent, showcased his comic chops on Last Comic Standing, and got a standing ovation for his performance on Conan. You can go to YouTube and look those up. Each appearance has reinforced his reputation as a performer who refuses to be boxed into a single category. What sets Greenbaum apart is his ability to weave genuine, quick-witted humor into his magic routines, creating an experience that feels fresh and unpredictable. Now, while many magicians use comedy as a supplement to their tricks, Greenbaum ensures that both elements stand on equal footing, making his shows a masterclass in entertainment. Having seen him perform and then attended his workshop, I realized that every little action, move, and line was extremely well thought and calculated. His routines are polished yet spontaneous, reflecting years of dedication to his craft and an innate ability to read and respond to his audience in real time. So beyond the stage, Greenbaum has also made a name for himself as a writer, director, and producer, lending his comic sensibilities to various projects. He's a frequent presence at magic conventions and comedy festivals, where he not only performs but also teaches and mentors aspiring entertainers. A former camper at Tannen's Magic Camp, he's been a regular counselor there for over 20 years. His contribution to both industries have earned him numerous awards as well as the respect from all his peers. As he continues to push the boundaries of what it means to be both a comedian and a magician, Greenbaum remains a trailblazer in a world that really sees such a successful fusion of these two art forms. His journey from an eager young magician and comedian to a seasoned world-class performer demonstrates the power of passion, persistence, and an unwavering commitment to making people laugh while keeping them on the edge of their seats, and is how Harrison has become one of, if not the, funniest magician on the planet. So I was able to sit down with Harrison, and here's the questions and the answers. I asked him, Harrison, which came first for you, comedy or magic? And now, from your perspective, which comes first in your show, the comedy or the magic? I'm curious, do you come up with a premise like a punchline, then find the trick to fit, or do you find a trick and write material around it? And here's what Harrison had to say. He said, who came first is an easier question, since the answer is the other person, hopefully, since I'm a generous lover. Which came first is a little trickier. There's a lot of humor in my family, so I've always loved comedy. But as a kid, I definitely got into magic first. When I was 5, my dad showed me a card trick, then refused to tell me how it worked, so I became obsessed. Doing magic, I was always dressing up in a suit or blazer, studying clean, focusing on the tricks. When all of a sudden I was wearing the clothes I wanted to use, using profanity, talking about whatever things that I was thinking about. It was like taking a hit of a totally new, pure drug that I immediately came addicted to. That summer, I was interning for Mad Magazine in their writing department by day, and by night handing out flyers on street corner for 2+ hours in exchange for being allowed to do 5 minutes at the end of the show. That's what comics call barking for stage time. I'm just realizing now that I said I became addicted to something and ended up working street corners, so I guess things could have turned out a lot worse, huh? In terms of my act, I try to distinguish myself as a comedian doing magic as opposed to nearly every other comedy magician who's a magician doing comedy. That means my creative orientation is comedy first. I do a lot of stand-up, 15 to 20 shows a week. So once I have a joke in my stand-up that's killing on its own, I will try to see if there's really a cool magical idea I can build off that. For example, my Price is Right routine started off as a Price is Right joke in my act, which led to me to wonder if I could play a magical game of Price is Right with the audience, which led to a routine that's now in my off-Broadway show. The other approach I'll take is essentially write the comedy script of an idea first and then figure out how the hell to make whatever I just wrote magically happen, since I'm not a wizard. For example, I came up with all the beats of the Fuck You card trick and a script before I even began to worry about a method. The end of the script is, and then I peel away the Fuck You sticker and it is the chosen card, which meant that I had to sit there and figure out how the hell to make that actually work. In You Are All Terrible, my lecture, which is now my book, the whole first half, Originality, is focused on the thesis that magicians are creating art backwards from the rest of the artistic community. Real artists come up with the idea first and then figure out how to express that through their technique, channeling it through their original voice and perspective. Magicians, on the other hand, too often just buy the trick and then figure out how to jam it into their act. That's not how artists create. That's how cover bands are formed. So whether I'm starting off with a joke for my act and figuring out how to turn that into a magical journey, or writing a script based on a funny what-if thought, I'm beginning with an idea and then, and only then, trying to figure out how to express that magically. So to answer all your questions, for those who just skipped to this part, magic came first as a kid. Comedy comes first in my creative process. And if you're one of those who's always coming first, try to picture what's under Jeff McBride's convention, Moo Moo, and you'll probably outlast whoever you're with. So the next question I asked Harrison is, who were your inspirations in comedy and magic growing up? You know, you have such a unique style that you have now become an influencer. And here's what he said. My earliest inspirations were comedy-based. My dad was a huge fan of Mel Brooks, so I remember being really young and watching Blazing Saddles for the first time. My grandmother, my mum's mum, an English teacher, also loved Mel, and we probably wore out the cassette tape of Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner's The 2,000-Year-Old Man while riding around in her white 1991 Volvo. My grandfather on my father's side also loved to tell really silly stories about a lovable idiot named Schlotsky, who just so happened to get into trouble very similar to the kind my sister, my cousins, and I were getting into, so the stories had great lessons in them too. That my grandfather had survived the Holocaust, he was in Auschwitz from the beginning of the war, surviving by doing jobs like cleaning the trains, and yet still had the greatest sense of humour, was a really powerful lesson to me about what comedy could do and mean. Magically, I started going to Monday Night Magic when I was very young. I was actually their very first charter member back when I was around 11 or 12 years old. 25 years later, I'm still unclear of what the benefits of that program were. I particularly loved the comedy acts like Simon Lovell, who was deliciously naughty both on and off stage. Amazing Jonathan obviously was a gigantic influence because I had never seen a magician do some of the things he did. He would curse, he would do crazy things to his assistant and volunteers. He would make references to adult things. He would insult magic while doing magic. AJ opened a lane for me that I don't think I never knew existed before. You know, in terms of becoming an influencer now myself, that's such a double-edged sword. On one hand, I'm glad that my work is known and enjoyed enough for people to be inspired by it. But on the other hand, I've seen some things too much influenced by my work to the point that it's less flattering and more just plain stealing. I'd argue that at least 95% of magicians are essentially magic cover bands, doing material they didn't create with scripts they didn't write based on performances they saw someone else do. But at least when people see a Beatles cover band, the Beatles get some credit. In magic, the artists being covered really do, which sucks. My goal is really to change all that. I'm glad that me pushing the limits of what I think a magician should be allowed to do, whether it's in terms of the adult language I use or the political nature of my bits or even my relationship with the audience, has inspired others to take risks and break stuff. But I've definitely seen some people try to emulate some of those things without realizing the level of care and expertise it takes to pull them off. For example, I've seen some magicians yelling at the audience more after seeing me, and that's not the correct lesson. The reason the boundary-pushing stuff I do, like screaming, works is because, one, I build up trust with the audience, and two, have an emotional and theatrical reason for what I'm doing. In other words, I'm not just there to scream. And three, there's a journey I'm taking to build up to these kind of things. For example, I'm not just screaming at random moments, but building dynamically to it. Let's look at career development, and here's a question I asked Harrison. One thing that impressed me was your advice to work the material. You perform more than any other person I know, and often to really hone the material. Can you explain this a little more? And his response, years and years ago, I started counting up how many shows I did each year, just so I had an idea of the numbers I was doing. I moved to New York 2 or 3 days before New Year's Eve in 2009, and since then, I've done more than 10,000 shows. You know, even during the pandemic, I tried to do the same number of virtual shows and live streams as I would have been doing if I could perform in person. Math-wise, if I stay on track for this year, that comes out to an average of nearly 13 shows a week, every week for the last 16 years. The real question is, why the hell would I do that? It is my belief when it comes to comedy and magic, the only way to get better is to do it in front of an audience, and you take in the data from the audience, for example, if, when they laugh and applaud, how they react, and then adjust based on that data. In my book, that loop is what I call the secret logarithm of comedy. Every time I go on stage, I get to turn that wheel once, perform, get data, adjust based on that data. I want an act that makes you laugh so hard it hurts, and the only way to get there is to turn the wheel as many times as possible. Another question I asked Harrison was, I'm curious about challenges you might have faced in the early days. A lot of magicians who do magic call themselves comedy magicians when there is no comedy, or they think they're funny, but they're just reciting Bob Orban jokes. So how did you handle convincing potential bookers that you aren't the average comedy magician? And Harrison's response was, let's get this right out of the way. If you're only doing jokes you saw other people do or read in a joke book, then you shouldn't be allowed to put comedy or comedian anywhere in your bio. In terms of convincing bookers that I'm not like those people, I'm still figuring it out. It's really not easy. As I mentioned before, most comedy magicians are magicians who actually do comedy, whereas I would describe myself as a comedian who does magic. That's because, first of all, I'm an actual comedian, so many of my shows are stand-up shows in which I do no magic at all. I think there are a few, if any, comedy magicians working today that if you took away their magic could still do an hour of comedy. So I pride myself on being able just to do that. If you can kill with comedy without magic, imagine what happens once you get to add that magic back in. And that's my secret formula, although I guess it's not so secret since it's now published in this magazine. Next section was balancing comedy and magic. So I asked Harrison, do you find one aspect, comedy or magic, more challenging than the other? And how do you maintain a balance between the two in your performances? And his response, I find I'm doing a lot of stand-up. I can't wait to do magic. And if I'm doing a lot of magic, I can't wait to do stand-up. It keeps things fresh and interesting for me while simultaneously guaranteeing I'll never be happy. Stand-up and magic are both challenging in completely different ways, which is part of the joy for me when combining the two. They light up different parts of my brain. So comedy is all about the language. I love getting technical in order to find the exact right word or the exact right amount of pause or emphasis to make a joke get the strongest laugh possible. And it really can be one word. I've had jokes so good from a good laugh to a great laugh from just changing an A to a the or something very minute. Magic often has a physical challenge, a tangibility attached to it. I have to create and build props as well as rehearse moves, sleights, and choreography to get the magic to work. Now, there are ways the challenges overlap too. For example, comedy and magic both require large amounts of effort in terms of nailing the misdirection required. But I love how putting stand-up and magic together calls on so many more of my skill sets. A balance-wise, since I'm a comedian who does magic, my rhythm when I'm performing is a stand-up comedian rhythm. That's a laugh every 10 to 20 seconds, which is way faster and more joke-dense than your typical magician who does comedy, who's maybe getting a laugh every 1 or 2 or 2 to 3 minutes. That means I need a lot more jokes and have a much bigger emphasis on laughs and humor. So the balance shifts a bit in that direction. All that being said, it's really important to me that the magic is as strong as the jokes. So I'm always trying to balance my time, attention, and energy to make the magic really powerful. There's an old cliche that a comedy magician is not good at comedy or magic, so combines the two to keep you from finding out. I'm trying to reverse that entirely. I want you in complete hysterics and total astonishment. I want your head to explode. Another question I asked Harrison was, how do you handle a joke or a set you are working on not landing during a performance? And his response was, Jerry Seinfeld once said, and I'm going to butcher this, so I apologize, that if you're killing 10 out of 10 times, you're not doing enough new material. I'm a strong believer that every show needs to have something new. That could be something really small, like I changed a word or two, or something huge, like I added in a completely new effect or changed the whole order of the show. The only way of doing a ton of shows makes you better as an artist if you're testing new things each time, since each time one of those new things succeeds, your show gets incrementally better. In terms of a joke or trick not working or landing, well, what do you mean, Paul? That's never happened to me. Perfect shows every time. Of course things go wrong. When I'm working on tricks, I'm trying to do what I call earning the trick. Since I'm a human being, there's no amount of rehearsing or performing that's going to guarantee that the trick will work perfectly every single time. Trust me, shit happens. My goal is to do a trick so many times that I've figured out every way it can go wrong and then come up with a way to get out of it and land the plane anyway. Jokes are interesting because you can't know for sure if something is funny until you do it in front of an audience. So you just have to try new material and see if it works. Sometimes it doesn't. When it happens, honesty is always the best policy. I have lines and bits for when a new joke doesn't work, and that gets big laughs, so I can turn those moments around. However, the big caveat is that you can't dip into that well too often. In a single performance, you get one or maybe two chances to use a saving line. If everything you're doing is working and a new joke doesn't get a huge reaction, the audience will generally be okay with that. Reverse that ratio and have the majority of your stuff not work, you end up losing the faith of the audience or worse, becoming another artist. So the next part was knowing yourself. You are so comfortable with who you are on stage that you can get away with it because it's all you. You take the audience on a wild ride and you can say things that I couldn't because it's coming from you, and you set everything up right from the get-go. Now, these are skills of somebody who knows the craft but also knows who they are. How did you get to this point, and how does one be themselves on stage. And Harrison's response was, the first thing I do is make fun of myself. I think self-deprecation helps earn a bit of collateral from the audience to then make fun of others. Magicians as a whole need to make fun of themselves more. I mean, you know you're not an actual wizard, right? You can't just walk out, claim to have powers, and never acknowledge that in itself is clinically insane, right? If you're going to poke fun of people, whether they're in the audience or others you're just talking about, you can't grant yourself an exception. In fact, you have to go even harder against yourself to show that it's fair. The second thing I try to do is demonstrate to the audience that I'm coming from a place of love. You can poke fun of someone in a way that tears them down, or you can poke fun of someone in a way that celebrates their weirdness and uniqueness. I want the audience to understand it's exclusively the latter. I'm also constantly gauging the audience to make sure I'm pushing them in a fun and comfortable way. If I get any indication that I'm not, I change course quickly. Finally, the third thing I do, rule of three, baby, is build trust with the audience. They need to know they're in good hands. I'm a skilled pilot. Even if you're not sure of the destination, I want you to trust in my ability to fly this plane and steer you the right way. I'm here for you to give you the best night of your life, something like a sex joke. In terms of being themselves on stage, when I was in college, I managed to get Mike Birbiglia to come to campus and speak to the stand-up club I had founded. Now, he mentioned that stand-up should feel like scabs being ripped off, so revealing that it's painful. He told us we should do stand-up that was so personal we'd be embarrassed if our parents were in the audience. Spoiler here, my parents have been in the audience a whole bunch of times, and they've definitely learned a lot about me. I love them so much, but there's a reason I don't ever let them sit in the front row at my shows. Now, those comments from Mike really had a profound effect on me and pushed me to strive to be as authentic and revealing as I can. When you watch a great comedian, you feel like you're learning so much about that person, how the comedian thinks, feels, personal things about the small and big things in that comedian's life. It's insane how many magicians' performances or shows I've seen, they get to the end of the audience having learned literally nothing about who they really are. That's insane. Art needs to express a point of view, your point of view. Long answer long, how do you be yourself on stage? You start by deciding to let the audience see who you really are. The next thing we looked at was audience interaction and feedback, and I asked him, how do you engage with your audience and how important is their reaction to your performance? You know, I loved your breakdown of using audience members throughout your show, starting with none but then involving the audience, then eventually having them one on stage. Other magicians start with audience members on stage right off the bat, but your way of getting to the point of them coming on stage throughout the show really made sense, and I changed my show because of it. So can you explain a little bit more about that and your thought process behind it? His answer was this. Audience reaction is so, so important. It's the fuel in the secret logarithm of comedy. Also, the audience is actually why I'm there. As Socrates once described in one of his histories, it's important not to walk on stage, see the audience, and think, you're welcome. But to walk on stage, see the audience and think, thank you so much. Okay, fine. That was something Taylor Swift said, not Socrates. I just wanted to sound extra smart there. In terms of the way I approach the audience interaction in my solo show, I've been working on the show I'm currently doing off-Broadway for over 15 years now. So, you know, I've had a lot of time to really work on that structure as a whole. Everything nests. There are 6 tricks in the show. In the middle are tricks 3 and 4, which connect in a surprising way. Outside those, 2 and 5 connect in an even more surprising way. And outside of those, forming the buns, are tricks 1 and 6, which serve as the introduction to who I am and then a summation of everything the show has been. So the tricks have a purposeful build in terms of audience interaction. Trick 1 is also a piece with no interaction. Trick 2 involves me talking to the audience who stay in their seats. Trick 3 involves me bringing an audience member to stand in front of the stage. Trick 4 finally has me bringing an audience member on stage with me, breaking that fourth wall. And trick 5, I actually go into the audience, climbing through and sometimes on them, getting close, really close. And trick 6 is nearly entirely a solo piece, bringing the attention back to me, but ending with a rapid-fire rant in which I summarize every audience interaction I've had, bringing the whole evening full circle. Again, there's that same nesting. Trick 3 and 4 both involve me having an extended interaction with one spectator, with 4 being a build-over, 3, since the person is now on stage and I'm directly interacting with them. Trick 2 and 5 involve me interacting with a lot of people in the audience. And finally, trick 1 and 6 involves a solo piece, with 6 being a build because I end by recalling everything I've done on the show. So it all comes back to building that relationship with the audience, that trust, slowly widening the spotlight to include as much of the audience as I can. Only took a decade and a half to figure that out, so, you know, it's easy. I then asked him, what's the best reaction you've ever received from an audience? And he said, it might sound sappy, but every laugh I get is the best reaction. Now, I'm actually going to stop the audio here, folks, because I've been reading for a while, and the rest of this you can read, but it's a great article. I wanted to give you the main points here. The article carries on probably for another 20 minutes, but it's going to be too long for this podcast. But this just gives you an idea of the incredible answers that were given, honest answers. They can really help you structure your show. Some really incredible tips and advice from probably, I think, the top comedy magician in the world right now. So if you want to read the rest of it, you can. I've given you the main part of the audio, and I certainly hope you enjoyed this.
Exclamation mark, or is that meaning? Question mark. Do you have it or do you not? Do you care? Here is why I care and have more than for a half century. I care primarily because magic provides a delicate human emotion, wonder. It does inspire hope and ignite creativity by a man blowing up a rubber glove and then milking it like a cow udder with real milk squirting out. A surreal sense. A rubber glove was given meaning by a clown with an idea. Thank you, Harpo Marx, Charlie Chaplin, and Stan Laurel. Whomever invented the gag, probably before all three were born. A series of checks was collected by the late Dr. Edwin A. Dawes. In his massive magic collection, he owned handwritten and signed checks by Keller, 1849 through 1922, Johnville Maskelyne, 1839 to 1917, and the great Lafayette, 1871 to 1911. Why would people preserve three thin pieces of paper for about 130 years, and then why would some pay auction prices to obtain and be the current and future owners of said documents? Why would someone spend millions of dollars on acquiring thousands of books, posters, ephemera, and painstakingly recreate an axe appearance, Cardini, at the Magic Castle? The installation alone took many thousands, museum-quality air control, stuff you don't even see, making sure Mr. Cardini's clothing continues to perform, even if he isn't wearing it. A tesseract incarnate, blood looking after blood. Meaning. You could just survive. Maybe that folding knife you carried in high school is still in your pocket. Maybe you don't think deeply. My opinion is you have to consider every detail before you present a feat of magic. Notice I did not write magic trick. The job of a magician is to create wonders, said S.H. Sharp and many others. Anything less than that is gimmickry and a bold embrace that people who sweated years to get seconds are nerds, jerks, and wonks. My sword is at the ready, my shield firmly in place. Wonder shall not fall on my watch. Back to meaning. We've been through three concepts in 3 months. Vanish, January, February, and March 2025. Let's recap. Mind Power Progression, 4 books. In case you're just joining the discussion, we now invite making your magic more memorable by adding an awareness of meaning, if not penetrating theater, or a transcendent component that may distinguish your theatrical offerings. All meaning is subjective. My mother spoke of riots in Tulsa, Oklahoma when she grew up in the 1920s, but I did not feel connected to the Indian slaughter pain. I did when Martin Scorsese made his film Epic Killers of the Flower Moon 2023. I saw it twice, once at the Directors Guild Theater with the star interviewed by a Variety critic. Actress Lily Gladstone is a Native American, and to be involved in the production of this film for about 3 years made during COVID, many firsts were achieved. I am sure the film had meaning for Native Americans to tell a true story of what happened to her people. What is your meaning? There are no wrong answers. I'll give you one example, only because I am thoroughly familiar with it. Not so hard. Pretty simple, in fact. As you'll all read in my obituary of David Lynch in the February issue of Vanish, he was loved the world over and helped over 1.5 million at-risk children and PTS victims receive transcendental meditation. The Department of Defense in the U.S. authorized over $20 million spent on something that abates widespread veterans' depression and suicide. Now, when Lynch died, a poster store in Lower Manhattan called Posteritati mounted a beautiful showcasing fine wood, huge glass cabinets of all of Lynch's film posters. I asked if they'd already had the exhibit up. Stan told me they got the news, and within 12 hours, the tribute show was up. In less than 24 hours, I was one of the first viewers of this resplendent exhibit. What could draw such attention? The tributes continued throughout the week. Even NASA chimed in with a black hole and Lynch's quote, "Concentrate on the donut, not the hole." The David Lynch Foundation and the Grand Central New York City Transcendental Meditation Center held a tribute 6 days later featuring DLF Chairman Bob Roth appearing in person from our 80-person gathering and live on the internet for the global thousands zoomed in. I knew this event would be special, so I ordered flowers sent. When designing the colors and order, I asked the Perrywater, New York City florist, specialist named Chris, why do you think someone mounts a poster show within hours and people the world over gather, watch videos, meditate, and offer flowers? Chris replied, well, this is the answer you're not going to like, but the poster people just want your money, and they're exploiting Lynch's death with tribute. Ouch! Double ouch! And you know what? Chris was right, partially. Because of further interactions with the Posteritati people, I now own a glorious 1988 Something Wild poster by Jonathan Demme. The meaning is that I attended 6 David Lynch memorial services. I can think of no better way to remember all this than with a poster that is very imaginative for its sex, art, and cinema. Around the same time that David Lynch passed, I started working intensely with a famous model. She seeks what I do and that which has meaning, breaking boundaries in other professions as she did in something, perhaps an accident of youth. That's her focus now. Did you know Michael Jordan played pro baseball after basketball? True. Same thing for her. I've spent my life in the service of new solutions to old problems. I took Dr. Edwin Dawes and his wife Amy and son Adrian to the Museum of Modern Art in New York City on several occasions. I showed Dr. Dawes my copious workbooks, like Howard Thurston, 1869 through 1936, had, of an effect I developed from 1988 to 2003. I asked the great historian if such work had ever been done with the prop I used. He said he didn't know, but would find out. Nearly a year later, we met at the Bryant Park Grill behind the New York Public Library, where Dr. Dawes was an avid viewer of the famous Hooker Magic book collection. It turned out, in Eddie's opinion, I was the first to do my act because the precursor had not been seen since David Devant in roughly 1896. I built on Devant's work. To me, that has meaning. Finally, in 2013, I was hired to perform as one of the opening acts in a very well-organized benefit for what was called Strike Debt Relief. See Vanish, January 2013. The bill included comedian actor Janine Garofalo and Thurston Moore of the New York-based band Sonic Youth. Physical comedian clown Peter Strauss provided an act that could not be followed. He blew away the house, dancing in only a hot pink thong. I made silver rings appear on each finger. The actor from Live Free or Die Hard, the fourth in the series, Justin Long, came up to me shortly after my act and tapped me on the shoulder. I spun around. He extended all of his fingers in front of my face like a fan and said, so I could hear amidst the 1,000 strong in the famous club Poisson Rouge, "That had meaning." Ben Robinson is a magician and author of 15 books. His latest, Magic Hall, 40 Stories of True Wonder.